You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last month, President Obama announced that he would send more American troops to Afghanistan, but Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid believes that diplomacy remains the most powerful weapon that America can use in South Asia. His book, Descent into Chaos, The U.S. and the Disaster in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia, has just been reissued in paperback by Penguin, and I'm pleased that it brings him back to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much.
Have things changed all that much since this book was published in hardcover last year?
Well, they've got actually much worse in both countries, and which is why there's an extra chapter in the book bringing you up to date, but also describing a further descent into chaos, if you like, a further deterioration.
Well, now there seem to be daily bombings in one part or another of Pakistan.
Well, exactly. I mean, there are an average of 3 or 4 suicide attacks a week now in Pakistan. Pakistan has become the real center. The Pakistani Taliban, these extremists who were stuck out in the mountainous east of the country for quite some years, have now rolled into the central valleys and plains of the country and don't seem to be having any opposition.
So is there a possibility that the Taliban might very well take over Pakistan in the way that they still threaten to take over Afghanistan?
Well, I don't think they'll take over Pakistan. Pakistan's a big country. It's 170 million people, many different ethnic groups and regions. But I think what we're going to see in Pakistan is a real slide into anarchy. Where the central government, I mean, even today, the central government does not control about 25% of the country's territory.
And it seems to be breaking up into some kind of a federal system where certain areas are being allowed to have different laws than the rest of the country.
Well, that, I think, has been disastrous. I mean, in the Swat Valley in the north, which the Taliban captured after defeating the army there last year, the government has conceded Sharia law, Islamic law. And that's a complete abrogation of the constitution, and it's not just Islamic law, it is their interpretation of Islamic law, which is so brutal.
Because Islamic law was instituted when General al-Haq, was it? Aziz al-Haq?
Zia-ul-Haq.
When he was ruling the country, he brought in Sharia law, and many people were shocked at that time.
Well, he introduced a few measures which were basically aimed at, which were basically anti-women. Containing, you know, women's rights, and there was an enormous protest, and many of these laws were actually rescinded after he died. Now we have a situation where, you know, but anyway, even that debate was at least between mainstream Islamic clerics. I mean, many people didn't like it. The debate now is between, you know, the fundamentalist version of Islam, which means, you know, hand chopping, executions, women being stoned.
Teenagers being whipped.
Yeah, teenagers being whipped. It's really directly aimed at restricting women's education even.
Well, let's go back to Afghanistan. Do you think that the additional 30,000 troops that President Obama has pledged can be effective in improving the situation in Afghanistan at this point?
Well, you know, I think the image in Afghanistan is that the Taliban are winning. And I think there was a great need for the U.S. and NATO to take back the military initiative. And certainly the Afghans are hoping, I think, that these extra troops and more to come possibly will win the retake the military initiative, reconquer some of the territory that has been lost, and get the Afghan army, which is now 90,000 strong and is a very efficient fighting force, to hold this area so that the development agencies and all can come in. But the real issue is what the Obama plan is to actually do what the Bush administration had promised to do but failed to do, which is rebuild the country. In other words, you know, get the Afghan economy going, provide the basics of roads, electricity, water, which again have not been provided in the last 8 years, get them in place so that the Afghans can start an economy and you can provide employment to people.
But that's the whole matter of nation building. And haven't we heard mixed messages, or didn't we hear mixed messages from the Bush administration in that regard? They said that they weren't interested in nation building. Donald Rumsfeld, in fact, said that when Kabul fell to the Northern Alliance in December 2001. And then when we invaded Iraq, we talked about nation building.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, mixed messages was the thing, but in practice, it was never done. Bush would blow hot and cold about nation building, especially as the Americans started preparing to invade Iraq and the Afghans got very worried that they would be relegated to a secondary third position, which they were, of course, once the insurgency in Iraq started. But really, you know, if you look at the Bush administration made exactly the same mistakes they made in Iraq as they did in Afghanistan. They were ill-prepared for the aftermath of militarily defeating the enemy. They had no teams in place. They had no proper aid-giving organizations. They had no expertise. They had no technocrats who could actually do the necessary bits and pieces of nation-building. And Afghanistan was just grossly neglected.
Is it part of the problem that we really know very little about the culture? We had problems earlier in response to the Soviet invasion, for example. It seemed like the United States had no idea of what Afghanistan was all about.
Well, I don't think that is a major problem. I think there are two problems. One is a lack of long-term commitment. You can't build nations as Bush wanted to do in 6 months or a year. You need a 4 or 5, maybe a decade-long commitment, as you did after the Second World War when you committed money to Europe, to South Korea, to Japan, and you rebuilt these countries. It took 10 years or so. The second thing is that you need the tools to carry out nation building. And I think what has happened in America after the end of the Cold War in the 1990s and the collapse of the Soviet Union, that those tools, in other words, the Agency for International Development, you had enormous civilian expertise in agriculture and construction and bridge building. You had engineers working for the government who would go out to third world countries. You know, all that has collapsed, basically. You now have the agency for AID, the Agency for International Development, is a part of the State Department. They sign checks to contractors, the Beltway bandits, who run off with this money, and they spend maybe 50-60% of it on the ground, and the rest is just eaten up in commissions. And so the money doesn't reach the ground. The wrong people have the money half the time because they don't have any understanding of Afghanistan. So what the administration lacks is the proper governmental agencies and expertise.
Are you encouraged that an experienced diplomat like Richard Holbrooke has been sent as a special envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan?
Yes, very much so. I mean, Holbrooke is certainly controversial, but he's very accomplished. He can be both incredibly charming and incredibly ruthless. And I think you need that combination. You are going to need a lot of banging of heads together in this region in order to improve the situation. And I think it's ideal. And most importantly, I think he's really grasped something that, you know, has a lot of mention in this book about the need for a regional solution. In other words, you can't tackle Afghanistan on its own or Pakistan. You have to involve the entire region because the region is getting destabilized.
What about the world? At what point did the United States start to look to the UN to take on nation building in Afghanistan?
Well, it certainly did, and the UN had a presence, an important presence in Afghanistan after 2001. But again, the resources weren't there. You know, the money wasn't there. The UN just did not have the capacity to, carry out the kind of heavy infrastructure, a building that was necessary. And that really could have only been carried out by the Americans. And of course, the Americans weren't there.
My guest is Ahmed Rashid. His latest book, Descent into Chaos, The U.S. and the Disaster in Pakistan and the Disaster in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. It is published now in paperback by Penguin with a new final chapter. We will continue our conversation after this. Later in this hour, Sir Jonathan Miller discusses his staging of Bach's St. Matthew Passion at BAM. And in our next hour, Dr. Sanjay Gupta with a scientific look at addiction on this week's Please Explain. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC receives support from
Purchase College, presenting the 28th Annual Natural and Social Sciences Student Research Symposium with over 50 senior research presentations presented by students of the School of Natural and Social Sciences. April 25th, free event, info at 914-251-6200.
Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Every Little Step. a new film by James Stern and Adam Del Deo about the journey of a chorus line from the very beginning, now playing. Plaza Jewish Community Chapel, owned and operated by the Jewish community, located at 91st Street in Amsterdam, offering a full range of funeral services, including pre-need arrangements, online at plazajewishcommunitychapel.org.
WNYC has been hanging out at your place for all this time. Now, we can finally invite you over to our place. Our new street-level broadcast studio opens on April 28th. The Jerome L. Green Performance Space will bring you news, drama, concerts, poetry, visual arts, debate, community events, and of course your favorite WNYC shows. Your place or ours? The Green Space. Information and tickets at wnyc.org/thegreenspace.
We're back with Ahmed Rashid, whose latest book is called Descent into Chaos, the U.S. and the Disaster in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia, now available in paperback from Penguin. What was the United States' relationship with Pakistan before the invasion of Afghanistan?
Well, it was very bad. There were sanctions against Pakistan because of its nuclear tests that had taken place 4 years earlier. There was no aid program. There were very severe sanctions, and Pakistan was not doing well. The moment that the 9/11 happened, of course, Bush gave an ultimatum to President Musharraf, at that time General Musharraf. There had been an army coup. He had taken over power. And the ultimatum was essentially, you're either with us or against us. And Pakistan, of course, had been the key factor in supporting the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. And Musharraf switched sides. But unfortunately, we thought that this would be a really great moment for Pakistan to now join the international community, drop its support for extremism. But Musharraf never really did a full U-turn. He did a kind of half U-turn.
And it's if you speak to people in the Taliban, I saw a film just the other day where reporters asked them, where do your arms come from? Where does your support come from? They said from the Pakistani government. So is the rumors are that it comes from Pakistani intelligence. Are they rogue elements, or are they simply doing what the leadership has wanted them to do, but with a certain amount of deniability?
Well, you know, I go into this in considerable detail in my book, and I mean, I have come to the conclusion that this is not rogue elements. This is state policy. This is policy as directed by the army. I mean, in Pakistan, the army controls foreign policy. It controls policy towards India, Afghanistan, the United States, and the army has harbored these Taliban for several reasons. First, they wanted to hedge their bets in Afghanistan. They thought the Americans, NATO, would leave quickly. They wanted to have this reserve force, which they thought could go in, you know, seize power again and turn, and the Kabul government would once again become a pro-Pakistan government. They wanted to keep India out of Afghanistan, which has certainly not worked because India has a very marked presence in Afghanistan. But they are very upset at that. And the third reason is that, you know, these fundamentalist groups, they feel, are owing to the Pakistan army, and so they'll do their bidding, which is no longer the case.
Sarah Chase, who used to be an NPR reporter, now lives in Kandahar, says that she feels that Pakistan has territorial designs on Afghanistan, and well, that's part of why its policy has been like this.
I don't know about territorial designs, but I think they want to, the military and the intelligence services want to exert a permanent kind of influence over Afghanistan and what kind of government comes into being there.
So when General Musharraf sanctioned the assault on the Red Mosque in July 2007, he seemed to be suggesting that he had changed his policy.
Not really, because even if you look back at the Red Mosque incident, you know, this had been building up for 6 months. If Musharraf had nipped it in the bud 6 months earlier, he would have just had to tackle 20 extremists with a few pistols. When he did finally tackle it, there were like 20,000 extremists, very heavily armed. And I think a lot of that was shadow play. You know, it was Musharraf trying to tell the international community, look, I'm threatened by these fundamentalists who've taken over over this mosque in Islamabad, the capital of the country. Give me more money. Give me more aid. Don't push me on other things. And it was this continuous game, unfortunately, which the Bush administration continued to fall for.
Do you think it's because they didn't really understand the politics of the area?
No, I think they were 90%. They were bogged down in Iraq. They didn't want any distractions. They didn't want to have to deal with the reality of what was going on in Pakistan or in Afghanistan. And if you remember, once the insurgency started in Iraq, I mean, it sucked all the air out of the room, as Colin Powell said.
What happened when Benazir Bhutto ran? Was she seen as too much of a threat to the domestic terrorists?
Well, you know, I think Benazir had matured a lot since she had ruled the country in the 1990s. She was taking a very hard line against the extremists.
Because she had supported the Taliban as well, hadn't she?
Well, back in 94, yes. But she was now taking a very hard line. She wanted to improve relations with India, with Afghanistan. She would have carried a lot of international clout. She would have got aid for Pakistan. And I think the country would have generally been more stable simply because she was a national leader and respected by everyone.
You write that President Asif Ali Zardari has always been a divisive figure. Could anyone have come into office after Musharraf and been able to bring about the necessary reforms?
Well, I think Benazir would have been the best person, certainly. I mean,
could she have gotten the military to go along with it?
Exactly.
Because the military pretty much controls Pakistan, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the military runs certainly foreign policy and interferes a lot in domestic policy, too. But Benazir was the only person with international backing who the army would have been slightly scared of. And I think she would have been able to take the army along. At the moment, the problem is that, with this intestine political infighting we've been having, Zardari commands very little respect and very little credibility right now. And even though he's the husband of Benazir, it's not his fault. I mean, he's been in jail 11 years. Then he was in exile. He lost touch with what was going on. And he's never been on the political stage before.
And he was reluctant to reinstate the judiciary. He only did it when he was absolutely forced to.
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, that whole issue goes back to this amnesty that was declared on corruption, and he had several corruption charges against him. He feared that this Chief Justice would come back and reopen those corruption charges.
So since the military also controls much of the economy in Pakistan, what is the relationship between the military and the civilian government at this point?
I think it's very tense. I mean, publicly, nothing is said, but internally, I think the military is simply not listening to the civilian government. I think the civilian government want to, go into these areas, confront the extremists. Only the army can do that. The army is making its own decisions. It's not listening to anyone, neither the Americans, nor is it listening to the civilian government.
My guest is Ahmed Rashid. His latest book, Descent into Chaos, has just been reissued in paperback, updated and reissued. In July, there are going to be elections in Afghanistan later this year. Do you think that those elections have the power to change the situation there to any degree?
Well, I certainly hope so, and I think the Afghans are hoping so. But I think, there are several issues before the elections. The first is that President Karzai will be standing as an incumbent. There will be many opposition candidates standing against him. There has to be a level playing field, and the Americans should not be taking sides with anyone. I think that's a very important issue. But certainly, these elections also have to be militarily made secure. I mean, you have to protect the electoral process. The NATO American troops have to protect the polling stations, make sure the Taliban are not going to attack them. There are a lot of issues that need to be resolved before the elections.
You mentioned India earlier. How much of a player is it? Thinking back to last year, of course, India's embassy in Kabul was bombed and Pakistan was blamed.
Well, exactly. I mean, one of the reasons the army gives for doing what it's doing, in other words, backing the Taliban, and backing the Afghan Taliban is that it says India is a major regional threat, not only to Pakistan from its western border, where, of course, we have a frontier with India, but also now on the Afghan border, because India is present in Kabul and India is undermining Pakistan from its embassy in Kabul. So this tit-for-tat war actually has been going on for the last 4 or 5 years, now based in Kabul. And obviously, it's been very debilitating and very dangerous because, but the two countries not seeing eye to eye, there's a kind of covert war going on.
And then there were the attacks in Mumbai last December. The Pakistani government denied for weeks that the attacks had been planned on Pakistani soil. Why did it feel the need to decide to deny it for so long when it was so obvious that it was the case?
Because a lot of these extremist groups and the very extremist groups, Lashkar-e-Taiba, that carried out the Mumbai attacks, were actually trained and put into place by the ISI, the Inter-Services Intelligence. That's the agency, the secret agency of the army. Now, many of these extremist groups still have links to the ISI. We still don't know who exactly ordered the Mumbai killings, but the fact is that even after Mumbai, it took a month for us to accept the fact that these guerrillas were Pakistani guerrillas who carried them out. And even now, you know, 3-4 months on, and despite the Indian and American pressure, we have still not properly shut down these groups. They're still operating.
And now there are parliamentary elections in India. They began earlier this week. What effect could they have on relations with Pakistan?
Well, you know, obviously Pakistanis are watching very carefully as to who's going to win this election. The Indians have said already publicly that they fear another terrorist attack could take place during these elections, which of course would really sink relations between Pakistan and India very rapidly. But the real issue is, you know, what kind of government comes in place. I think Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, who heads the Congress Party, has been quite restrained in his relations with Pakistan, in the sense he hasn't gone overboard blaming Pakistan for everything. And there have been a string of bomb attacks, suicide attacks in Indian cities over the last 2 years. The BJP, which is the Hindu fundamentalist party which ruled India before, is much more hardline towards Pakistan. And if they come into power, certainly, you know, we could have a political crisis between the two countries.
Today there was news that Pakistan has received $5.28 billion to combat the Taliban and stabilize its economy. Is the economy a major part of the problem here, a part that's overlooked?
It's a huge part of the problem. You know, we have something like 25% inflation. We've got.
When you say we, you're speaking as
Pakistan,
a Pakistani.
Pakistan. And Pakistan has got something, you know, it's a crippling economic situation. 30-40% joblessness. Industry is completely paralyzed. There's no electricity. Major cities have 4 or 5 hours of electricity a day. It's a very bad situation.
And in today's New York Times, there's a report that the Taliban is exploiting class differences to gain ground in Pakistan, especially in the Swat Valley, where earlier this week the regional government voted to allow Islamic law to be imposed.
Well, in some parts of Pakistan that's true, but I think by and large most people are very much against the Taliban. The issue is that they don't have effective leadership guiding them as to how to stand up against the Taliban. The military is not providing any leadership. The civilian government is too intent in fighting its political rivals rather than providing the leadership. I think the majority of Pakistanis, like the majority of Afghans, want nothing to do with the Taliban.
But obviously the Taliban do have some appeal for disaffected poor youth.
Yes, they do. I mean, in the north of the country, they do. And the other factor is, don't forget that they've been using terror tactics. For example, now in the Swat Valley where they are, they're insisting that every family gives a male member to their battalions. Now, that is forced, you know, conscription, if you like.
How much of the tension we're seeing in Pakistan and Afghanistan has to do with the fact of the Sunni-Shiite split? Because there have been any number of attacks on Shiites in Pakistan. I don't know how big a minority there is. And then we just had all of this latest thing where Afghanistan passed a new law which applies only to Shiite Muslims. And that has gotten a lot of people upset because it doesn't give women the right to deny their husbands sex.
You know, in Pakistan, the Shia minority is about 20%, but and they've lived peacefully for decades along with the Sunnis, and there's been no problem. But in the last 10 years or so, there's been the rise, sponsored by Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, there's been a rise in these Sunni extremist groups who want to eliminate all Shias from Pakistan, just as the Taliban and Al-Qaeda tried to do in Afghanistan in the 1990s. And the Taliban are very much against the Shias. And it's their inspiration that is making some of these young men attack Shias. Now, in Afghanistan, I think, you know, this was a very stupid move by President Karzai, without a doubt.
He's saying he regrets it.
Yeah, well, it was connected to pleasing the Shia clergy because he's going in for elections and he wanted the vote bank that the Shia clergy have. Now, Shias constitute only 10% of the Afghan population, but it is an important section of people for Karzai to win over. And in the last presidential elections in 2004, the Shias overwhelmingly supported Karzai because he was so much in favor of minority rights.
Gabrielle in Brooklyn left a question on our show page. She asked, what will the mission of the added troops in Afghanistan be? Will this exacerbate the situation? Does the Obama administration appear to be rethinking the unmanned drone attacks on Pakistani and Afghani villages?
Well, I think their mission will be, first of all, a lot of the Marines will be deployed in the south. They will main initiative will be to take back territory from the Taliban, hold it, hand it over to the Afghan army, and allow development agencies and the NGOs to come in and do serious development work. I think the other mission, obviously, will be to go after Al-Qaeda. The third mission will be to increase and speed up the formation of the Afghan army and police, which is going to need a lot more trainers, both European and American. As far as the drones is concerned, yes, it is a very contentious issue in Pakistan. But I think increasingly, you know, with this paralysis by the Pakistan government and the army, more and more sort of urban educated Pakistanis are saying, well, you know, if the army is not taking out these bad guys, and if the Americans are, we should let the Americans continue doing it, even though there are civilian casualties along this route.
I still get the feeling from this conversation that the situation is that you're not all that optimistic about the future.
I'm not optimistic about Pakistan. I think the situation in Pakistan is even more dire than Afghanistan, simply because there's a lack of leadership and will. I think Afghanistan is still doable if the Americans actually and NATO pursue the right policies or pursue the policies that were promised 8 years ago. Will Obama have the staying power? Will the American public have the staying power if, for example, there are very heavy casualties this summer as American troops go up against the Taliban? There's already a lot of talk about, you know, this is Obama's Vietnam, the graveyard of empires.
It was the Soviet Union's Vietnam.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't believe that is applicable because I think the majority of Afghans don't want the Taliban back. And the Afghans are very clear about this. But really, it's a question of commitment, I think, you know, by this administration and doing the right things, not doing the wrong things like President Bush did.
Ahmed Rashid is a Pakistani journalist who is based in Lahore and writes for the Daily Telegraph of London, the Washington Post, the International Herald Tribune, the New York Review of Books, BBC Online, and The Nation. His latest book is called Descent into Chaos, the U.S. and the Disaster in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia, now available in paperback from Penguin. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you very much indeed.